Good morning, and welcome to Seattle and to our William K. Nakamura Courthouse. This is the time set for oral argument in the case of
anything either. He didn't agree with anything the prosecution did.
Well, I think it goes back to the holding from Lemos that said in the Heck analysis you have to look back to what the factual basis is.
But how is that different than this case?
It's different in this case because it was a no contest plea, no particular factual basis was ever determined, just like the general verdict in Lemos that could have been based on multiple factual bases.
What do you do with Sanders? Because Sanders was a no contest plea, and there the court said, we said, there were multiple instances that could be the basis for the conviction. The no contest plea was vague, and so it construed it as covering all of those things and said the Heck bar applies because the stipulation was to all of the things, not just one of the many things.
I think that to the extent Sanders can be read to indicate that holding, it was abrogated by Lemos, and that was flagged by the dissenting opinion in Lemos to say, you know, the Lemos majority opinion is inconsistent with Sanders, so Lemos has impliedly overruled that portion of Sanders, especially the part of it that says, you know, you can't be slicing and dicing up the particular facts of the incident. If there was resisting arrest, there can't be excessive force.
I didn't see in Sanders where the parties made this argument. That opinion uses the word stipulated and it refers to this transcript, but it didn't seem that there was teed up or any engagement, any pushback, frankly, by the defendant in the way this defendant is pushing back on the nature of a West plea and what it means to proffer a factual basis for the plea. Was that at issue in Sanders?
I think it was not. And so that's another way to handle Sanders is to say that particular argument was presented. And so Sanders isn't authority for that proposition because that argument wasn't squarely presented.
If Sanders doesn't grapple with it, do we have any existing case law that does? Did we miss anything? Or is this the first time?
I believe this is the first time that the court has determined exactly what is the proper analysis in a nolo or a no contest plea and what needs to be compared between the civil case and the criminal case in order to do a proper Heck analysis.
And so would you, I guess, what is your argument here? I mean, should we follow what the Seventh Circuit did in McCann or what the 11th Circuit did in Dixon?
This court should follow what the 11th Circuit has done and what the 10th Circuit has done. And also, I think it's just a very small extension of what this circuit has already done in Lemos to say that essentially where there are multiple potential options for what could make a valid conviction, any one of which could make the conviction valid, and there is some version of that criminal valid conviction under which the now turned civil plaintiff can succeed on a claim for excessive force without invalidating that conviction, then the case is not Heck barred.
So what do you see as the alternatives that would cause you to win under Lemos? What are the alternative bases for the Section 69 conviction?
The throwing of the elbow multiple times, any one elbow attempt.
At whom was that thrown?
The elbow, the charging documents say that the elbow was thrown multiple times at Villegas, and that that King succeeded in hitting Villegas while he was being pushed up against the wall, and then on the ground thrashing was with both defendants.
When you say charging document, I'm sorry, you mean his complaint?
No, I'm sorry. I mean the prosecution's allegations that were attached to the plea indicate multiple potential bases for which
he could have pled. To get back to Judge Collins's point, he could have pled nolo to the elbowing.
Yes.
Is that your point?
Yes.
But don't we know there's one point in the plea colloquy where the prosecutor specifically says that the 69 charge is going to be based on both officers, says I'm going to put both officers on the count. Doesn't that suggest that it's the thrashing on the ground, which was the only thing factually that involved both officers and not the throws to Villegas?
Ultimately, he only pleaded no contest to a single count.
Right, but it's described by the prosecutor. I'm on ER 168. That would be PC 69 for one-third the midterm, striking the strike for 8 months, putting both officers' names on the count so that both of them were the subject of the obstruction. That tells us it's the thrashing on the ground and not the solo violence to Villegas, doesn't it? And therefore, you lose under Limos. It's only one set of facts that fits both officers.
I don't think so, because I don't think that Mr. King had to accept that it was both officers. I think he just had to say somewhere in this incident, there is enough to convict me validly for resisting arrest. I don't think
I understood from the plea call, that was a pro-defense thing to put both officers on to prevent there from being a separate charge.
Yes, that's true. That he only had to accept a single count instead of multiple, and that affected his strikes and things like that.
The consequence of that is we know which conduct underlies both officers.
I think the correct analysis is not that he was saying, I'm implying that it must have been the thrashing and not the elbowing. It's that he was just saying, I understand that the prosecution has enough of a factual basis that I can knowingly and voluntarily plead to this charge without accepting anything in particular about it. And that's essentially what a no contest plea is, that they can say whatever they want, but he's just saying, all I'm saying is that the essential elements of one claim is enough.
Bucket of conduct that could support the Penal Code 69 charge with respect to Cruz other than the thrashing?
No, I think only the thrashing applied to Cruz. But then this court needs to determine if there's any path in which they could say, okay, so King, if for example, for the sake of argument, this court says it must have been the thrashing, then King could have a separate claim to say, well, when I was slammed up against the wall for no reason, that was excessive force, and it was not the lawful force was in reaction to me thrashing on the ground. And there is a path because there are multiple acts of purported resistance plus multiple acts of force throughout the entire incident that it can't be heck barred because the resistance at point B is not inconsistent with excessive force at point A or vice versa.
Could I get you to just engage in this other hypothetical, because I'm trying to figure out whether you're making another argument or not. Chief Judge McGee just asked you about the Dixon case, and she's compared the 7th versus the 11th, and you embrace the Dixon case, the 11th Circuit case. So in my hypothetical, let's say all of the no contest plea was premised on the second charge for the reasons Judge Collins just mentioned, right? The thrashing on the floor. It seems to me, but I'd be interested in hearing what both sides have to say about this. It seems to me that under the Dixon rule that you're advocating, if he's thrashing on the floor and he throws an elbow and connects and he pleads no contest to that, that under the Dixon rule, there's still a path if their response is truly disproportionate and would support an Eighth Amendment claim. What I can't tell is whether that's what you are arguing when you say that you're embracing the Dixon claim.
That is the argument that we are making, that even if he had that any one of the versions of resisting arrest that were alleged in the prosecution's documents, there is still a path to say, well, the excessive force continued longer than it should have or was disproportionate.
So that's, you know, that's what I referred to when I was talking earlier about the Dixon case where the hypothetical where a person stopped, officers approach the car, she hits the gas. She winds up pleading to that. That's as assaultive conduct, but they respond by shooting her. Mm-hmm. It's truly an extreme case. And so my question earlier, and now I'd like to ask you to revisit because I think we're communicating more clearly, is whether or not that would require an expansion of our case law, allowing the Eighth Amendment, right, if the responsive assault is truly disproportionate. Would heck bar that, or would that require an expansion of our case law?
No, I don't think heck would bar that, and I don't think it would require an expansion of the case law either. I think that is consistent, for example, with the Hooper case where the person says, yes, I resisted when I was being arrested for shoplifting, but then a canine tore her scalp off, and that was clearly disproportionate to the resistance. And
I think that's right, and that's the case that I think it is most closely analogous, but we would have to stitch those together. I don't think we've stitched them together, have we?
I don't think it has been particularly clear, and that would be very helpful for this en banc court to clarify exactly why an excessive force claim for either excessive force that occurs after resistance has ended, such as in Limos, or that was clearly disproportionate to the needs for responding to the force, either one of those is not heck barred because a successful civil judgment on the excessive force claim would not necessarily invalidate the conviction, and so therefore it is not heck barred.
Mr. King's complaint seeks expungement of his disciplinary conviction. Should we just disregard that as, you know, liberal construction of a pro se pleading, or how should we deal with that?
I think you could disregard that under the liberal pro se rules, but also that refers to his disciplinary conviction within the prison, not his criminal conviction based on his later no contest plea.
Right? It's the same facts for both his prison disciplinary action and his criminal conviction.
Yes, correct.
Same incident.
Yes, yes. Okay. So I think that can be disregarded.
And why should a court's analysis of records from a no-lo plea for the heck bar be treated like the admission of evidence under the federal rules of evidence?
Well, I think that it is because the purposes under Rule 410 are essentially to say that a no-contest plea or a no-lo plea in the federal context is just simply not probative evidence of anything underlying the plea. So if you treat any of that as true, any of that information, it has the same problems with reliability and lack of probative value. That is the same reason that Rule 410 prohibits it being used in a more traditional evidentiary situation, such as before a jury.
And so then, under your view, then, would all the rules of evidence apply?
Potentially.
Like, you could argue 403. You could hit hearsay, 801c2. We could have an evidentiary hearing every time we're going to have a heck analysis.
Well, I think, yes, that would be important, because in assessing the heck bar, the court should not be treating as true something that has not been either adjudicated or true or doesn't have evidentiary value.
So we're clear then. Your position is it's not just 410 that would apply. Any rule of evidence would apply to this analysis.
Potentially. I haven't thought through sort of every permutation, if some are specific.
Once you say 410, I don't know any rule that says only one evidentiary rule applies and all the rest don't. Seems to me they all would apply.
I think they probably would. Many of them probably aren't relevant.
So then you could object on hearsay then, say that the factual basis that the police wanted to enter or the prosecution wanted to enter, that's a government report. That's 801c2. That's a statement offered for the truth in written form. It doesn't qualify as a hearsay exception. So for that additional reason, we couldn't consider that information.
Potentially, but I guess I'm having difficulty conceiving of a situation in which that would be important for the heck analysis in the first place, of why
the state wants that prison report in. They need that prison report. Mm-hmm. And you're going to say, well, it's not admissible, 801c2.
Yes. And I think that for many reasons, the court in doing the heck analysis should not consider that prison report.
Do you know of any case law ever that has said the rules of evidence that would apply to a trial or a hearing, an evidentiary hearing, would apply in a heck analysis?
I do not. I don't believe that question has been raised earlier than when the three-judge panel considered it in this case. And
Go ahead.
Have a preferred ground for reversal between 410 and Lemos and Martel? And if so, why?
The Lemos and Martel analysis is our preferred ground. I think it's the cleanest. It's the most conservative in terms of not staking out new law. It just says the analysis from Lemos applied in a no-lo context is the same because there's no stipulated factual basis. So that's our preferred disposition.
Now, when you say preferred, does that mean you're abandoning, or you just you think you'd like to win on that one? You'd be happy to win on either.
As an advocate for my client, I'd be happy to get a reversal no matter what. But we think that the best analysis would be the Lemos and Martel analysis.
Let me ask again. Are you abandoning any argument under Rule 10, or are you saying that is an additional possible ground on which the court might rule in your favor?
Well, we're not abandoning it in part because we never advocated for the position that was accepted in the majority opinions analysis. If this court decides that that's the correct rule of law, the reversal is what my client needs, but I don't think we're abandoning it, in part because we never advocated for it. Okay. But I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Yes.
May it please the court, Kyle Ha for the defendants.
In Heck v. Humphrey, the Supreme Court held that a civil claim for damages must be dismissed if success on the claim would necessarily imply the invalidity of the person's prior sentence. The doctrine channels challenges to prior convictions through habeas, preventing parallel litigation, collateral attacks on conviction.
Anything either. He didn't agree with anything the prosecution did.
Well, I think it goes back to the holding from Lemos that said in the Heck analysis, you have to look back to what the factual basis is.
But how is that different than this case?
It's different in this case because it was a no contest plea, no particular factual basis was ever determined, just like the general verdict in Lemos that could have been based on multiple factual bases.
What do you do with Sanders? Because Sanders was a no contest plea, and there the court said, there were multiple instances that could be the basis for the conviction. The no contest plea was vague, and so it construed it as covering all of those things and said the Heck bar applies because the stipulation was to all of the things, not just one of the many things.
I think that to the extent Sanders can be read to indicate that holding, it was abrogated by Lemos, and that was flagged by the dissenting opinion in Lemos to say, the Lemos majority opinion is inconsistent with Sanders, so Lemos has impliedly overruled that portion of Sanders, especially the part of it that says, you can't be slicing and dicing up the particular facts of the incident. If there was resisting arrest, there can't be excessive force.
I didn't see in Sanders where the parties made this argument, where that opinion uses the word stipulated and it refers to this transcript, but it didn't seem that there was teed up or any engagement, any pushback, frankly, by the defendant in the way this defendant is pushing back on the nature of a West plea and what it means to proffer a factual basis for the plea. Was that at issue in Sanders?
I think it was not. And so that's another way to handle Sanders is to say that particular argument was presented. And so Sanders isn't authority for that proposition because that argument wasn't squarely presented.
If Sanders doesn't grapple with it, do we have any existing case law that does? Did we miss anything? Or is this the first time?
I believe this is the first time that the court has determined exactly what is the proper analysis in a nolo or a no contest plea and what needs to be compared between the civil case and the criminal case in order to do a proper Heck analysis.
And so would you, what is your argument here? I mean, should we follow what the Seventh Circuit did in McCann or what the 11th Circuit did in Dixon?
This court should follow what the 11th Circuit has done and what the 10th Circuit has done. And also, I think it's just a very small extension of what this circuit has already done in Lemos to say that essentially where there are multiple potential options for what could make a valid conviction, any one of which could make the conviction valid, and there is some version of that criminal valid conviction under which the now turned civil plaintiff can succeed on a claim for excessive force without invalidating that conviction, then the case is not Heck barred.
So what do you see as the alternatives that would cause you to win under Lemos? What are the alternative bases for the Section 69 conviction?
The throwing of the elbow multiple times, any one elbow attempt.
At whom was that thrown?
The elbow, the charging documents say that the elbow was thrown multiple times at Villegas, and that that King succeeded in hitting Villegas while he was being pushed up against the wall, and then on the ground thrashing was with both defendants.
When you say charging document, I'm sorry, you mean his complaint?
No, I'm sorry. I mean the prosecution's allegations that were attached to the plea indicate multiple potential bases for
he
which
could have pled, to get back to Judge Collins's point, he could have pled nolo to the elbowing.
Is
that your point?
Yes.
But don't we know there's one point in the plea colloquy where the prosecutor specifically says that the 69 charge is going to be based on both officers, says I'm going to put both officers on the count. Doesn't that suggest that it's the thrashing on the ground, which was the only thing factually that involved both officers and not the throws to Villegas?
Ultimately, he only pleaded no contest to a single count.
Right, but it's described by the prosecutor. I'm on ER 168. That would be PC 69 for one-third the midterm, striking the strike for 8 months, putting both officers' names on the count, so that both of them were the subject of the obstruction. That tells us it's the thrashing on the ground and not the solo violence to Villegas, doesn't it? And therefore, you lose under Limos. It's only one set of facts that fits both officers.
I don't think so, because I don't think that Mr. King had to accept that it was both officers. I think he just had to say somewhere in this incident, there's enough to convict me validly for resisting arrest. I don't think
I understood from the plea call, that was a pro-defense thing to put both officers on to prevent there from being a separate charge.
Yes, that's true. That he only had to accept a single count instead of multiple, and that affected his strikes and things
but
like
that. The consequence of that is we know which conduct underlies both officers.
I think the correct analysis is not that he was saying, I'm implying that it must have been the thrashing and not the elbowing. It's that he was just saying, I understand that the prosecution has enough of a factual basis that I can knowingly and voluntarily plead to this charge without accepting anything in particular about it. And that's essentially what a no contest plea is, that they can say whatever they want, but he's just saying, all I'm saying is that the essential elements of one claim is enough.
Bucket of conduct that could support the Penal Code 69 charge with respect to Cruz other than the thrashing?
No, I think only the thrashing applied to Cruz. But then this court needs to determine if there's any path in which they could say, okay, so King, if for example, for the sake of argument, this court says it must have been the thrashing, then King could have a separate claim to say, well, when I was slammed up against the wall for no reason, that was excessive force, and it was not the lawful force was in reaction to me thrashing on the ground. And there is a path because there are multiple acts of purported resistance plus multiple acts of force throughout the entire incident that it can't be heck barred because the resistance at point B is not inconsistent with excessive force at point A or vice versa.
Could I get you to just engage in this other hypothetical, because I'm trying to figure out whether you're making another argument or not. Chief Judge McGee just asked you about the Dixon case, and she's compared the 7th versus the 11th, and you embrace the Dixon case, the 11th Circuit case. So in my hypothetical, let's say all of the no contest plea was premised on the second charge for the reasons Judge Collins just mentioned, right? The thrashing on the floor. It seems to me, but I'd be interested in hearing what both sides have to say about this. It seems to me that under the Dixon rule that you're advocating, if he's thrashing on the floor and he throws an elbow and connects and he pleads no contest to that, that under the Dixon rule, there's still a path. If their response is truly disproportionate and would support an Eighth Amendment claim. What I can't tell is whether that's what you are arguing when you say that you're embracing the Dixon claim.
That is the argument that we are making, that even if he had that any one of the versions of resisting arrest that were alleged in the prosecution's documents, there is still a path to say, well, the excessive force continued longer than it should have or was disproportionate.
So that's, you know, that's what I referred to when I was talking earlier about the Dixon case where the hypothetical where a person stopped, officers approach the car, she hits the gas. She winds up pleading to that. That's assaultive conduct, but they respond by shooting her. Mm-hmm. So it's truly an extreme case. And so my question earlier, and now I'd like to ask you to revisit because I think we're communicating more clearly, is whether or not that would require an expansion of our case law, allowing the Eighth Amendment, right, if the responsive assault is truly disproportionate. Would heck bar that, or would that require an expansion of our case law?
No, I don't think heck would bar that, and I don't think it would require an expansion of the case law either. I think that is consistent, for example, with the Hooper case where the person says, yes, I resisted when I was being arrested for shoplifting, but then a canine tore her scalp off, and that was clearly disproportionate to the resistance. And
I think that's right, and that's the case that I think is most closely analogous, but we would have to stitch those together. I don't think we've stitched them together, have we?
I don't think it has been particularly clear, and that would be very helpful for this en banc court to clarify exactly why an excessive force claim for either excessive force that occurs after resistance has ended, such as in Lemos, or that was clearly disproportionate to the needs for responding to the force, either one of those is not heck barred because a successful civil judgment on the excessive force claim would not necessarily invalidate the conviction, and so therefore it is not heck barred.
Mr. King's complaint seeks expungement of his disciplinary conviction. Should we just disregard that as, you know, liberal construction of a pro se pleading, or how should we deal with that?
I think you could disregard that under the liberal pro se rules, but also that refers to his disciplinary conviction within the prison, not his criminal conviction based on his later no contest plea.
Right. It's the same facts for both his prison disciplinary action and his criminal conviction.
Yes, correct.
Same incident.
Yes, yes. Okay. So I think that can be disregarded.
And why should a court's analysis of records from a no-lo plea for the heck bar be treated like the admission of evidence under the federal rules of evidence?
Well, I think that it is because the purposes under Rule 410 are essentially to say that a no-contest plea or a no-lo plea in the federal context is just simply not probative evidence of anything underlying the plea. So if you treat any of that as true, any of that information, it has the same problems with reliability and lack of probative value. That is the same reason that Rule 410 prohibits it being used in a more traditional evidentiary situation, such as before a jury.
And so then, under your view, then, would all the rules of evidence apply?
Potentially.
Like, you could argue 403. You could hit hearsay, 801c2. We could have an evidentiary hearing every time we're going to have a heck analysis.
Well, I think, yes, that would be important, because in assessing the heck bar, the court should not be treating as true something that has not been either adjudicated or true or doesn't have evidentiary value.
So we're clear then. Your position is it's not just 410 that would apply. Any rule of evidence would apply to this analysis.
Potentially. I haven't thought through sort of every permutation,
well, I mean,
if some are specific
to... Once you say 410, I don't know any rule that says only one evidentiary rule applies and all the rest don't. Seems to me they all would apply.
I think they probably would. Many of them probably aren't relevant.
So then
but...
you could object on hearsay then. Say that the factual basis that the police wanted to enter or the prosecution wanted to enter, that's a government report. That's 801c2. That's a statement offered for the truth in written form. It doesn't qualify as a hearsay exception. So for that additional reason, we couldn't consider that information.
Potentially, but I guess I'm having difficulty conceiving of a situation in which that would be important for the heck analysis in the first place, and why the court would be considering it.
I think the state wants that prison report in. They need that prison report.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to say, well, it's not admissible, 801c2.
Yes, and I think that for many reasons, the court in doing the heck analysis should not consider that prison report.
Do you know of any case law ever that has said the rules of evidence that would apply to a trial or a hearing, an evidentiary hearing, would apply in a heck analysis?
I do not. I don't believe that question has been raised earlier than when the three-judge panel considered it in this case. And
Did you want to reserve? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Do you have a preferred ground for reversal between 410 and Lemos and Martel? And if so, why?
The Lemos and Martel analysis is our preferred ground. I think it's the cleanest. It's the most conservative in terms of not staking out new law. It just says the analysis from Lemos applied in a no-lo context is the same because there's no stipulated factual basis. So that's our preferred disposition.
Now, when you say preferred, does that mean you're abandoning, or you just you think you'd like to win on that one? You'd be happy to win on either.
As an advocate for my client, I'd be happy to get a reversal no matter what. But we think that the best analysis would be the Lemos and Martel analysis.
Let me ask again. Are you abandoning any argument under Rule 10, or are you saying that is an additional possible ground on which the court might rule in your favor?
Well, we're not abandoning it in part because we never advocated for the position that was accepted in the majority opinions analysis. If this court decides that that's the correct rule of law, the reversal is what my client needs, but I don't think we're abandoning it, in part because we never advocated for it. Okay. But I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank
May it please the court, Kyle Ha for the defendants. In Heck v. Humphrey, the Supreme Court held that a civil claim for damages must be dismissed if success on the claim would necessarily imply the invalidity of the person's prior sentence. The doctrine channels challenges to prior convictions through habeas, preventing parallel litigation, collateral attacks on conviction, excessive force applied after the fact.
But what about the Hooper case? That's the case that opposing counsel points us to.
So in Hooper, she actually alleged that she had stopped resisting after the opinion notes that she was initially resisting and stopped resisting, and then the dog bite happened after the resistance had ended. And so you can have two separate factual contexts is the way that Yount, the California Supreme Court, case refers to it.
Circle back to Judge Forrest's point. I was going to say, if you could circle back to Judge Forrest's point, but maybe she's getting ready to take you there, Gordy.
Yeah, I mean, this is the allegation from the civil lawsuit. While plaintiff was laying on the ground in compliance and not putting up any form of struggle or resistance, Cruz struck the plaintiff with a closed fist on the right eye. So it could be that he resisted all the way up in time until he gets handcuffed and he's on the ground and he's now in compliance, because that's consistent with the officer's statements that are connected to the PC declaration, that at some point he was handcuffed and on the ground and no longer resisting. And it could be true that excessive force was used at that point.
So I think if he had pled differently, that might be the case. But because
I just read you what he pled.
Right. But he there are other allegations that say he never provoked and that at all times mentioned he was in handcuffs, restraints, and never provoked the officers, and that he was not resisting when he was on the ground. So there needs to be some point during this interaction, because he stipulated to there being a factual basis in these records from this August 17th interaction, that there was a factual basis for his plea. At some point in that interaction, there needs to be an opportunity for there to have been resistance while.
But that's why Judge Collins is pointing to you to the mysterious missing indictment. So we're looking to see, it seems reading between the lines, but I do think we're left reading between the lines, that charge, the amended charge, is that he was thrashing or maybe threw an elbow when he's on the ground. And then the complaint, I think, very clearly alleges that he's prone on the ground. Cruz ran in later, right? By the time Cruz gets there, he's on the ground, he's down, and he alleges that Cruz took what he took, as you know, extreme response. So why isn't that the path?
I think the problem is that where does the valid conviction lie? Because he's alleged that earlier he didn't provoke he didn't provoke Officer Villegas. So there has to be a point in this interaction where you could fit in a valid conviction without there being some excessive use of force in order for the conviction to remain valid.
Why is that true after Hooper? That's why I think we're just missing each other.
So again, in Hooper, there was a longer interaction. She agrees that she was resisting at first. That's the main distinction. She agrees she was resisting at first and then stopped resisting when the dog bite happened.
I understand that, but you're just not grappling with Judge Miller's point, which is that we have a pro se complaint and he could amend the complaint, couldn't he?
We don't think
some of his allegations. Or I guess that's what you're saying, is just futile. He just is locked in. He can't do that.
We think based on
you're resisting, I think, are hypothetical for that reason. Is that it?
Yes. I mean, we don't think that he could amend. I do think that if you thought that amendment was possible, you could. There could be a hypothetical world in which he alleged a different type of case. But we think based on the litigation.
And why can't he amend?
We think he can't amend because there was a deposition in this civil case. I'll note it's not in the record. It wasn't submitted as an exhibit to a district court filing or anything like that. But he did testify in his deposition to what he alleged in the complaint, which is that he never swung at, never punched either officer, and that he wasn't aggressive. Essentially, he was saying, I did nothing wrong during this interaction.
But the Heck analysis looks to whether a successful judgment would invalidate the conviction, not whether individual allegations would. And so, in this case, a successful judgment wouldn't necessarily imply that the conviction's not valid.
So we think that you have to read the use of the term judgment there in the context of the decision as a whole, because this court has repeatedly emphasized, as has the Supreme Court, that judicial opinions shouldn't be read like statutes. And if you consider that word in the context of the decision in Heck as a whole, it's clear that the Supreme Court was trying to prevent parallel litigation, collateral attacks on convictions, and potentially conflicting judgments. And those issues arise when you have inconsistent allegations, because they ask a jury or a judge as a fact finder to reweigh whether the plaintiff ever actually here, for instance, actually resisted an officer during this interaction.
Let me ask, you seem to imply this in your supplemental briefing, but I just want to make sure that it's confirmed. So it seems in your briefing that you agree that Rule 410's text bars a plea or plea statements from being considered in the Heck analysis, but not the conviction itself. Is that right?
That's what we, if Rule 410 applies, yes, then we think that. We agree with that.
So then if the plea statements incorporate the police reports that may be incorporated into a charging document or, you know, just otherwise incorporate the police reports as the factual basis for the nolo plea, then why shouldn't those also be barred from consideration in the Heck analysis?
So the Rule 410 doesn't bar the admission of non-plea records from the criminal case. So that's the sort of starting point that as a matter of the text, they're not barred. If the court thought it had to
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but my hypothetical is the plea statement itself, which you just conceded would be barred by Rule 410, incorporates the charging document. So then why doesn't that bar also apply to what's been incorporated into that plea statement, which is the charging documents?
So is your hypothetical, you know, this case where he stipulated to there being a factual basis in the probable cause?
The charging document incorporated these police reports. So the question is, if you agree that the plea statement itself cannot be considered in the Heck bar analysis, then why can't the information, the documents that are incorporated into that plea statement also be barred?
Because they're separate documents. And in fact, the court could look to the plea colloquy just for the purposes of understanding whether the probable cause declaration and crime incident report are relevant to the question of what the factual basis is for the conviction.
The rule. That distinction that you're drawing is not in the plain text of the rule, right?
But the plain text of the rule doesn't bar anything other than, as relevant here, the nolo plea and the plea colloquy. So these other records can come in under the rule. I will say if you're worried,
just the facts and those statements are orally agreed to and are part of the plea colloquy, right? Let's say it's not even a separate document, but the entire text of that has been orally incorporated into that plea colloquy, then you would agree that should be barred, right?
No, I would say you couldn't look to the plea colloquy for that, but you could look to underlying records. And if the defendant ended up reading those into the record, again, you can't look to that, the plea colloquy itself, but you could look to the documents underlying it. But I do want to emphasize that the court doesn't even need to look to those, the probable cause declaration or the crime incident report. The court can look to the criminal complaint and the criminal case information, which make clear that on August 17th, 2016, the charges that he committed a battery against Officer Villegas, and there was the charge later added for resisting an officer. King, of course, alleges in his civil complaint an interaction on August 17th, 2016, and he's never disputed that these are the same interaction. And so because he says that he didn't resist, he didn't provoke the officers during this interaction, just the fact of the conviction based on those charging documents, the complaint and the criminal case information, which aren't tied up in the plea colloquy, the court can determine that this is Heck barred because it would imply the invalidity of his conviction for resisting an officer.
Is it possible that there's not another charging document because was this 69 considered a lesser included offense of what he's charged with in this complaint on ER 120?
Not that I'm aware of. Okay. My understanding had been that this was just added later. Okay. But I haven't seen the actual, an amended criminal complaint.
A moment ago, in fact, several moments ago, you said if 410 applies, are you arguing that it does not?
Yes. Our first line argument is that Rule 410 doesn't apply at all because when a court considers these documents for the purposes of Heck, it's not admitting into evidence those documents. And that's this case, this court's case in Arrington. It is unpublished, but that case held that you're not admitting documents within the meaning of Rule 410 when you're considering them as a court for Heck purposes.
So you're saying Rule 410 says it's not admissible as evidence, but a court can consider it as if it were evidence? I mean, that's what's going on. I mean, it's considering it for the truth of whatever may be contained therein. That strikes me as considering it as if it were evidence.
Well, it's not being, I think the focus is on the word admitting. It's not being admitted into evidence the way something would be at a trial. And I don't think that it's being considered for the truth in that manner because this is a nolo case. We're not saying that he admitted to every single fact alleged in the probable cause declaration and the crime incident report, just that he agreed that there was, he conceded at least the basic elements of the crime, including resisting an officer.
Counsel, I had a question for you. In the the supplemental brief, the one you most recently filed, we asked about the Olivier Supreme Court decision. And in your brief, you said Olivier has no impact on our case. I was kind of surprised that you said that, because that's a no-low plea case where the Supreme Court did analyze it under Heck. Seems to me that it's very relevant to the 410 question, because the 410 state analog was raised in an amicus brief in that case, and the Supreme Court didn't take the bait. The Supreme Court just directly went from NOLO to the Heck analysis. So it's still your position that Olivier has no relevance, or just I just want to make sure I understand your position, because we have to write an opinion, and there's this Supreme Court case from like 2 months ago.
Yes. No, I actually wasn't aware of that, Your Honor, and I do think that that makes a difference. I think our main point was that Olivier dealt with prospective claims for prospective injunctive relief. And our point was just that by saying that the Heck bar didn't apply to those claims, it wasn't changing anything about the Heck
doctrine. But on page 920, it says Olivier pleaded no contest in municipal court. So, I mean, I think that was the reason why I thought the case was significant. You know, maybe others disagreed, but I just want to make sense. Assuming that Olivier is a no contest plea, assume that for a moment, what should we take from that case?
I think what we should take from that case is that the court didn't say, just because this is a no contest plea, you know, Rule 410 would bar anything about it, and we can't apply a Heck analysis. The reason why the case was resolved the way it was because it was a claim for prospective relief.
But the other problem with Olivier is that he didn't concede any of it. He didn't dispute any of it. He said, yes, I preached out there where I'm not supposed to preach, and he was concerned about vindicating his constitutional rights going forward. There was no question what he'd done there, right? I think the opinion makes that really clear.
I think it does as well, but I think the fact that it was a no contest plea is relevant in that the court didn't take that opportunity to say that the Heck analysis is different because of the fact that it's a no contest plea.
The court didn't have an opportunity to do that, I don't think, counsel. Please feel free to push back. But I think the reason the court didn't have the opportunity to do that is because there was no disputed facts about what happened, right, retrospectively, that formed the basis of his plea. He preached out where he wasn't supposed to preach, and he was trying to actually vindicate that point, that he should be allowed to stand there and do what he was doing. But that's why you have 11 judges giving you a rough morning here, because we don't have uncontested facts, and we're trying to figure out what facts we will proceed from, and is there really no path forward for this person? For me, that's the big limitation on Olivier.
Yeah, I mean, I will say, I think there's no path forward for him, given the allegations he's made. I do think that ordinarily Heck is raised at the motion to dismiss stage quite frequently when leave to amend is liberally granted. And so I do think that in many circumstances, plaintiffs may be able to amend their complaint to remove inconsistent factual allegations and potentially plead around the Heck bar. So we think that's possible. We think it's really a case-specific issue here.
I do too. I think these cases are often very fact-specific. And so we're a little hamstrung and maybe doubly hamstrung. Wrong for one reason I didn't recognize until we came into the courtroom, and one I guess I did. But we don't have the amended charging document that he pled no contest to. There's no questions about that. And then, of course, we don't have the deposition transcript either. And that's, I think you've been very candid about saying we don't, and that we're not in a position to say that amendment would be futile. And another court would need to make that determination. But hence the hot seat you're on. This is a tough spot for us to really say this is a consistent with our precedent.
We understand that, and we do think that if the court thought that this complaint could be fixed, if there were some people who thought that it could be fixed, it could be sent back to the district court for it to determine whether leave to amend should be granted.
So would you advocate for Dixon or McCann for us to look at either of those two cases?
So we think the inconsistent factual allegations rule, it's not just McCann in the Seventh Circuit. The Tenth Circuit's adopted it, the Fifth Circuit, the California Supreme Court. So we think the Eleventh Circuit's the outlier. And we think that it makes sense to go with this inconsistent factual allegations rule, in part because of administrability concerns. So in the ordinary course of civil litigation, if there are improper allegations that can't proceed, the plaintiff is the complaint's dismissed with leave to amend, and the burden is on the plaintiff to fix the complaint. And we think that that's the proper course here, rather than the burden being on the court to sort of redline the complaint and issue sort of in limine orders precluding, evidence coming in based on inconsistent factual allegations.
Counsel, did you just say, sorry, I was taking a note. Did you just say that the 11th Circuit is an outlier?
Yes.
What about the 10th Circuit?
So the 10th Circuit, in the case Torres cited by my friend on the other side, actually distinguished Havens, which was the case that we cited for the 10th Circuit being on our side of this. And the big distinction between Havens and Torres is that Havens is a case like this one where the plaintiff said that he basically did nothing wrong during the whole interaction, whereas in Torres, there was a concession that there was some resistance or violence early on. I think it was in Torres, she was driving towards the officers, and she conceded
stop,
that
she hit the gas. That was the allegedly assaultive conduct, right?
Well, this was the one where she drove towards the officers. They shot at her, and then she was driving away from them. And when her back was to them, they continued shooting at her. And so she said she conceded that liability couldn't be based on the first half of that interaction because she was posing a threat of danger to them, but said that liability could be based on the latter half of that.
Well, exactly. That's why it seems to me to be comparable to Dixon, so that there's some concession, some plea. Or conviction, let's just say conviction, forget how you get there, to the defendant, who's now the 1983 plaintiff, having used some degree of force that warranted the element, satisfied the element for purposes of the charge. And then she's got a 1983 claim that the 10th and 11th, I think, but in this case, the 10th allowed to go forward because the response was very disproportionate. It has to be extreme. But how is that not what we're talking about here?
I don't think it was a disproportionate issue. It was, I think the difference here is that there was a concession in Torres that she couldn't impose liability based on the earlier part of that interaction because she had a valid conviction and she was posing a threat to the officers' lives at the time she was driving towards them. So the use of force at that point was valid. It's after she's driving away, when she's no longer posing a threat of force, that it was there was excessive force that she could seek. But that's not what we have here, because again, the difference here is that he's alleged that he was not provoked and not resisting during the whole thing. There's no concession, and again, we think based on his deposition testimony, it would be hard for him to change his story now.
Yeah, but what I was trying to, that's in that way, it lines up with your earlier argument, which I appreciate, and I think we've all listened very attentively. But I'm trying to figure out why you think the 10th's precedent differs from the precedent in the 11th Circuit.
I see my time has expired. Might I answer your question?
Not the boss.
Yes.
I think that the 10th of the 11th, the 10th Circuit case we relied on Havens, we think is the closest analog to this case. Where
not relying on Torres is the answer to my question.
Sure, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. We ask that the court affirm the judgment of the district court.
Give you 2 minutes, so we've been over on the other side.
Great, thank you. Mm-hmm. I'd like to begin by providing a quick citation in response to Judge Collins's question. So the amended charging document, it's a criminal case information statement, is at 2 ER 101. It has a bare listing of the battery charge and the Section 69 charge with no narrative, no names of any particular victims whatsoever. And then at 2 ER 105, the state trial court noted the disposition of the plea and also included the amount of the fine.
Those are just docket notations. It isn't the document.
It's the most that is in, I believe, the federal court record about when the Section 69 charge got added to be against.
Okay. I mean, we have docket entries that show it's there, but we don't actually have the document that has the actual charging language.
Correct. There's no charging language other than those two pages that have the two separate charges and then the disposition. That's, I believe, all that we have.
If this case were to be remanded, is your firm going to stick with it? Or are you going to say good luck?
We only do appeals, so we would have to try to coordinate trial counsel to represent Mr. King. We couldn't represent him in a trial court.
I had a quick question. I understand you prefer the Lemos ground of reversal, but is there any unintended consequence or downside that you see with the 410 ground?
I think to the extent that the majority opinion can be read to say that when there is a NOLO or no contest plea, you don't even do a Heck analysis, that could potentially have some unintended consequences. And I'm thinking of a scenario like the facts of Heck, for example, where a criminal defendant who pleads NOLO or no contest then has a claim that says, oh, there was prosecutorial misconduct that meant that that plea was unconstitutional and needs to be reversed. That's a situation where that is the exclusive realm of a criminal appeal or a habeas petition. So the Heck analysis would have to apply to that and Heck would have to bar it. So to the extent the current majority opinion would not even begin that Heck analysis because of Rule 410, we think that would be in tension with Heck and create some potential unintended consequences. I'd like to address
your friend on the other side over here about the sort of timing of things here, where Mr. King's civil complaint was filed, I think, a year before the criminal charges were brought, and there hasn't been any amendment of that civil complaint. What are your thoughts about amendment to address any of the sort of inconsistencies that might be present between his allegations and the facts that the officers put in their incident reports with respect to the charges brought?
I think it would be entirely appropriate for there to be a remand that says, now that you have been essentially convicted of at least some acts of resistance, to the extent your complaint says you never resisted, you know, you need to try to narrow that. An amendment would be an appropriate way to do that. And I think it's important to remember, as Judge Koh mentioned, that Heck doesn't look to just what all of the allegations are in the complaint. It looks to what is necessary to actually prove a judgment. And that's from the language of Justice Scalia in Heck versus Humphrey. It says you look the damages actions that necessarily require the plaintiff to prove the unlawfulness of his conviction is what is barred. It's not correct what the second district judge did in this case to say, I'm reading all of the allegations in the complaint and I'm reading all of the allegations in the charging documents, and these two stories don't match up, so it's Heck barred. That's not what Heck is. It's not a freewheeling point of judicial estoppel to say you can never change your story or narrow your allegations based on a later conviction. Heck is a much narrower doctrine than that, and it would be completely appropriate to say, you know, you can't go so far as to say, I never resisted, but you can say, okay, there was at least one act of resistance, but there was still excessive force. That's completely fair game.
Thank you. Ms. Powell, Ms. Hall, appreciate your oral argument presentations here today. The case of Jerry Lee King versus R. Villegas et al. Is now submitted. We are adjourned. Thank you.
All rise.